Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, January 29th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. Let's start off with a look at the weather for today. Mostly cloudy with an east-southeasterly wind at 10 to 20 miles per hour, a high of 27, a low of 23. Tomorrow, a wintry mix is likely, windy, high 32, low 27. For Sunday, a chance of snow, windy again, with a high of 30 and a low of 16. Then, on Monday, partly sunny, high of 23 and a low of 7. On our front page today, our first story is by Lee Hermison and Marissa Payne of the Gazette. Shovel sidewalk or foot the bill. Full width, down to concrete. Those simple words of wisdom from Iowa City Senior Housing Inspector Stan Laverman, meaning to shovel snow the full width of the sidewalk down to the concrete, are pretty much all it takes to keep the city from sending someone out to clear your sidewalk after a snowstorm and then billing you for it. Even so, city officials in Iowa City and Cedar Rapids say they are deploying contractors and crews out to hundreds of residences this winter for failing to remove snow from the sidewalks. Laverman said Iowa City has received 428 different complaints so far this winter, which has consisted of 5 snow events by the city's count. In Iowa City, residents have 24 hours to clear their sidewalks after a snowfall. If the city receives a complaint, an inspector will confirm the complaint, leave a notice, and give the resident another 24 hours to comply before sending out a private contractor. While the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted the way many people work, recreate, commute, and attend school, that hasn't translated into any significant changes in the number of complaints, according to Laverman, who said, "I've not seen a noticeable uptick in complaints." Most complaints come from people walking to or from work or getting outdoors for exercise, Laverman said. The city tracked complaints in the last few years to see if there were any socioeconomic connections. He said, "What we found is Iowa City as a whole complains. It doesn't matter what census tract you're in. We were getting complaints at pretty much an equal amount across the city." The cost of sending Iowa City's third-party contractor for snow removal, which is Hawkeye Construction and Snow Removal, will add up fast for residents. Laverman said Hawkeye charges $150 an hour in 30-minute increments for shoveling, plus additional charges for using ice melt or equipment. He said, and they're typically not 15-minute jobs. The minimum $75 visit also comes with a $100 administrative fee from the city. Laverman said the fee has been at that amount for roughly a decade, and it's based on the staff time needed to respond to complaints, do invoices, and respond to resident questions. While that fee no longer covers the cost of that administrative work, Laverman said he's not considering increasing it. The City of Cedar Rapids' minimum fee has remained $313 since city officials scaled back the charge after the City Council in fall of 2019 had approved a higher fee structure with a minimum of $511 per job. That $313 minimum charge still is in place this year, though residents could individually be charged more based on the work required. Property owners must clear their adjacent sidewalks within 48 hours of a snowfall or ignore subsequent warnings and face the penalty. Before billing the property owner for snow removal, the city sends a warning letter to violators. If a crew has to clear the snow, the city bills the property owner. Cedar Rapids Utilities Director Roy Hesseman said in a statement, "We take such pride in being a community of good neighbors, so we often ask neighbors to check in with each other, determine any shared challenges, and lend a helping hand to neighbors in need. We find that a good neighbor attitude can limit the need for the city to correct code compliance issues. Unfortunately, when a property owner is unresponsive to our letter reminding them of their snow clearing obligation, we are left to clear the sidewalks to ensure safe passage for all residents. We are always ready to respond to warranted complaints as they come in following winter storm events. So far, residents have made 282 reports about sidewalks this winter, only 18 shy of the 300 complaints received last winter. 91 reports have escalated to a code case this winter. Solid Waste and Recycling Manager Mark Jones said, "The limited number of compliance issues pop up across the city pretty randomly, with no identifiable pattern as to the most common reporting locations." The Public Works Department's Streets Division has abated 35 sidewalks this winter, which is slightly less than the 41 cleared last year. Hesseman said it is difficult to predict if there will be more this year compared with last winter, though it appears likely because of the snow events forecast. Hesseman said several factors can contribute to the number of snow removal jobs we undertake each year, including the number and intensity of snow events, the length of time between snow events, and the number of reports filed by residents. With all these variables, it is difficult to extrapolate a strong trend when comparing the data year over year. With two heavy snow events this year and some winter weather likely ahead, you could say snow and ice accumulations have stuck around longer and may have been less likely to melt off with time this year compared to other years. The National Weather Service forecasts a more than 80% chance of a wintry mix in snow starting tomorrow afternoon, with possibly up to an inch accumulation. Also on the front page, a story by James Q. Lynch of the Gazette, "Iowa Voters to Decide Pro-Gun Amendment." In addition to electing a U.S. Senator and Governor in November of 2022, Iowa voters will be asked to amend the state constitution to give gun rights more protection from legal challenges. The Iowa House and Iowa Senate approved Senate Joint Resolution 7, a proposal to add language to the Iowa Constitution to say, quote, "The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The fundamental individual right, any and all restrictions of this right shall be subject to strict scrutiny." Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Brad Zahn of Urbandale, who noted that Iowa is one of only six states without any language in their constitutions about Second Amendment rights, said, "It's a very important resolution." The proposed amendment is going to give the voters of Iowa the opportunity in November of 2022 to decide how important are your Second Amendment rights. The language on the ballot is pretty straightforward. This resolution is not changing any federal laws or state laws. This resolution is pretty simple to protect Iowan's Second Amendment rights. But it's not that simple, argued Senator Kevin Kinney, a Democrat from Oxford who is a retired sheriff's deputy. He said, "I'm happy to place the Second Amendment in the Iowa Constitution, but what we're putting into the Constitution is not the Second Amendment. That's because the drafter added the strict scrutiny language. Strict scrutiny is the highest level of judicial scrutiny there is, according to Zahn. Such a strict standard for limiting gun rights is needed because, quote, it seems like there's an endless amount of lawyers out there and an endless amount of advocacy groups that want to wipe this out of the Constitution," said Senator Dan Dawson. Kinney doubted many senators have had to look down the barrel of a gun, as I have on a number of occasions. Adding the strict scrutiny requirement is going to make law enforcement more dangerous because requirements for background checks and permits to carry may be struck down. To fix that, Representative Wes Breckinridge offered an amendment during the House debate to substitute the words of the Second Amendment in the U.S. Bill of Rights. Adopted in 1791, that amendment reads, "A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed." It stood the test of time, including court battles, said Breckinridge, who worked for 27 years in law enforcement. It didn't stand the test of the GOP-controlled House. Representative Jennifer Confirst of Windsor Heights tried to offer language to say that strict scrutiny would not be applied to current state or federal laws or regulations relating to background checks. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Stephen Holt said background checks are federal law, not subject to the Iowa Constitution, and the amendment failed. Legislators are pushing a constitutional change without knowing the impact on current laws, according to Senate Minority Leader Zach Walls of Coralville. He said, and that's by design. This is about putting a loophole in Iowa law that is going to allow unelected judges to strike down laws passed by the legislature. In the end, the measure passed along party lines, 29-18 in the Senate and 58-41 in the House. From the Iowa Today page is a story written by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette, Iowa's public universities get more aid from second stimulus. Iowa's three public universities are getting between 50% and 60% more federal aid from a second COVID-19 stimulus package than from the original Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act passed last March. The portion that will go to student financial aid is smaller this time, at least at the University of Iowa and the University of Northern Iowa. Iowa State University officials are still reviewing the funding guidance and do not yet have a breakdown for how the funds will be distributed, according to ISU spokeswoman Angie Hunt. In total, the UI is getting nearly $25 million in federal support following December approval of a second stimulus package. That is about 54% more than the $16.2 million it got in the spring. Iowa State is receiving $32.4 million from the second round of aid, nearly 50% more than it received last year. UNI is getting $12.1 million this time, up 59%. The schools had to use at least half their spring allocation on emergency aid for students, but the second federal package requires only that schools match the spring aid. Because all three of Iowa's public universities are getting more money this time, the mandatory student aid cut is a smaller percentage of the total. UI officials have confirmed they're planning to spend $16.9 million of their second allocation on institutional support and $88.1 million on student aid, the same amount spent on student aid last spring. UNI officials also told the Gazette they're spending $8.27 million of their most recent allocation on institutional support and $3.81 million on student aid, the same as last spring. UI and UNI officials said this week they're reviewing federal guidance on how to distribute the funds and will share more information about how students can apply for aid. Last spring, the UI distributed $8.1 million of its CARES Act funds via grants to 4,700 eligible students experiencing financial difficulties related to COVID-19. The institutional aid covered losses from canceled study abroad experiences, closed residence halls, curtailed recreation and Iowa Memorial Union programming and general use, and technology upgrades for expanded virtual instruction. Iowa State distributed its $10.8 million for student aid last spring to 7,206 students. The institutional support covered losses from housing refunds, campus safety upgrades, and technological needs. Another change in the new stimulus package requires universities to prioritize aid for students with, quote, exceptional need, like those who qualify for Pell Grant funding, although students don't need to qualify to get a grant. And according to the federal guidance, institutions can't condition financial aid on continued or future enrollment, or use the grants to satisfy a student's outstanding account balance unless the student consents, or require each consent as a condition of getting the aid. Students getting a grant can spend the money on any costs of attending the university for emergency costs that arise due to coronavirus, such as tuition, food, housing, health care, including mental health care, or child care. Also from the Iowa Today page, a story written by Gage Miskimen of the Gazette, Iowa adds more cases of COVID-19 and more deaths. Gage says, Iowa on Thursday reported 1,257 new coronavirus cases and 32 confirmed deaths. Iowa's seven-day average for new cases is now 1,022. Linn County yesterday reported 75 new cases, which is ahead of its seven-day average of 55. To date, 18,261 virus cases have been reported in Linn County since March. Johnson County reported 44 new cases, bringing that county's total since March to 12,398. Johnson's 7-day average is 33. As of yesterday, Iowa has reported 316,437 COVID-19 cases since last March, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. Of the 32 deaths reported yesterday, Linn and Johnson counties each reported one. Since last March, Linn County has reported 281 deaths and Johnson County 55. Black Hawk and Polk counties reported 3 deaths each yesterday. As of yesterday, 60 of Iowa's long-term care facilities were experiencing virus outbreaks, a decrease of 2 since Wednesday. Since the start of the pandemic, 1,888 individuals in care facilities have died of the virus, an increase of 15 in the last 24-hour period. Briarwood Healthcare Center in Iowa City remains at 18 cases with 2 new recoveries for a total of 8 recoveries. Lantern Park Specialty Care in Coralville remains at 40 cases with 2 new recoveries for a total of 32 recoveries. In Cedar County, Clarence Nursing Home was removed from the outbreak list. An outbreak is defined as 3 or more coronavirus cases among residents and staff. One of our top stories today is written by Trish Mahaffey of the Gazette. CR doctor pays $100,000 for prescribing unneeded opioids. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. A Cedar Rapids family medicine physician has agreed to pay $100,000 to resolve allegations that he prescribed opioids to patients who had no legitimate medical reason for the drug. Dr. Paul Lotus is accused of violating the Controlled Substances Act from August 2017 to April 2019 when he wrote opioid prescriptions for 2 patients that had no legitimate medical purpose and were not issued in the usual course of professional practices, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Lotus also agreed not to reapply for a controlled substances registration with the Drug Enforcement Administration for a period of 3 years. Without this registration, Lotus will not be able to prescribe controlled substances. The claims resolved by the settlement are allegations only, and there has been no determination of liability, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office. U.S. Attorney Peter Deegan said in a statement, "Overprescribing is a major factor in the devastating opioid epidemic facing our country. As this settlement demonstrates, our office is committed to using all available tools to fight this epidemic, including civil prosecution under the Controlled Substances Act." Sarah Boblenz, the manager of the DEA's Omaha Division Diversion Program, said in a statement that the DEA and its law enforcement partners, quote, "will continue to investigate all practitioners who cause harm to the public and fuel the opioid epidemic." Trish Mahaffey of the Gazette has another story. Lawyers spar over subpoenas in Molly Tibbetts' murder case. Dateline, Montezuma. Attorneys involved in the first-degree murder trial of Christian Bahena Rivera, accused of killing University of Iowa student Molly Tibbetts in 2018, spent yesterday arguing about subpoenas, specifically the defense lawyer's effort to obtain Tibbetts' banking records. In a motion filed this week, prosecutors argued the defense lawyers were not playing by the rules when it subpoenaed Tibbetts' banking records from Bankers Trust in Des Moines. Defense attorney Jennifer Fries countered during a Thursday video hearing that her office had not notified prosecutors of the subpoena as required by law because of a clerical oversight and not because the defense was trying to be tricky. It turned out Bankers Trust didn't have any banking records for Tibbetts anyway, leading 8th Judicial District Judge Joel Yates to ask yesterday if, quote, "we're really fighting about nothing at this point." Assistant Iowa Attorney General Scott Brown said that was correct, but when he filed the motion to quash Freeze's subpoena, he didn't know the subpoena had produced nothing. The issue remains that the defense didn't follow the rules and process to obtain a subpoena, which involves notifying prosecutors and entering it on court records. The defense doesn't understand what that means, he said. According to Iowa law, a defendant can't obtain routine pretrial access to records of anyone who is not a witness unless ordered by the court. Brown said that in his written argument, adding, I'm suspicious that there are other subpoenas out there. Brown asked the court to quash this subpoena and make the defense follow the process. Freese didn't explain the effort to find Tibbetts' banking records during the hearing, but in her written argument said she and her husband, co-counsel, were following up on an investigation started by the state into Tibbetts' bank records. A tip was made to law enforcement August 1st of 2018 from a bank employee that Tibbetts had set up a bank account just before her death. There also was information a transaction was made on the account at a tattoo shop after her death, according to the motion. Law enforcement didn't follow up on this tip, so the defense is merely trying to fill the holes in law enforcement's investigation, Freese said in her written argument. She couldn't reveal more specifics about the subpoena without revealing their trial strategy, she said. Freese said the defense will likely send out several more subpoenas, including for bank records and information on the Iowa Sex Offender Registry. Yates, the judge, said potential witnesses can't be subpoenaed. He said he would review the issues and file a written order as soon as possible. Bahena Rivera, a Mexican national living illegally in the United States, is accused of fatally stabbing the 20-year-old Tibbetts, who went missing July 18, 2018, while jogging in her hometown of Brooklyn. Her body was found August 21st in a cornfield where Bahena Rivera led authorities. His trial is set for May 17th. Law enforcement received a tip that Molly Tibbetts had set up a bank account just before her death, and defense attorneys were merely trying to fill in the holes in the investigation. Moving on now to our community letters. There's one today from Sonia Ettinger of Iowa City. It says, give the new president a shot at solving issues. Sonia says, those who are chanting, not my president, could try taking a moment to reevaluate. Elections always declare a winner. This is not new. There will always be those who do not like an outcome, for multiple reasons. But disliking an outcome does not give anyone a license to incite violence or insult or not to follow laws, especially when they relate to health and safety. A clear majority of people wanted a change in administration, as they had spent 4 years being unhappy with many factors, including the huge rise in COVID infections and deaths. Our country has many problems, but none can be addressed properly until the infection rates are brought under control. It is surely reasonable to allow a new administration a turn to try to solve these issues, yet we all have a part to play, including wearing a mask in public. It is childish to refuse to do this. It is such a small requirement. How is that our state government cannot require masks for those working in the legislature, supposedly discussing public needs? The federal government has called for masks for 100 days in federal offices. Should the state be resisting such a simple action? That is from Sonia Ettinger of Iowa City. And now today's Gazette editorial called Get Educated on Vaccines. The Gazette says, frustrated at the slow rollout of coronavirus vaccines, Iowans are wondering when it will be their turn to get jabbed. Governor Kim Reynolds announced last week that the state will soon expand vaccine eligibility to all Iowans age 65 and older, as well as additional pools of essential workers, including law enforcement and educators. That's more than 500,000 newly eligible Iowans, even as the state is only getting a weekly allotment of about 20,000 doses, of which each patient will need 2. Reynolds is in a difficult position, trying to juggle a long list of priority groups and a limited supply of vaccines. Still, her administration could do a better job giving Iowans timely information. As of this week, days before Phase 1B of Iowa's vaccine plan is set to begin, the vaccine information link on Iowa's COVID-19 website has data on vaccines already administered, but nothing about how to get one. Linn County providers are starting to schedule vaccine appointments, but there is no statewide clearinghouse for county-by-county information. Reynolds' announcement this week that the state will launch an online map listing vaccine providers is a welcome development, although Iowans may be connected with providers who still don't know when vaccines will be available. is hardly helpful to Iowans who don't have internet access or primary care providers. In the absence of pertinent information from the state, pharmacies and medical offices have been flooded with questions they don't have answers to. The Gazette's Michaela Ram reported last week. Instead, Iowans are instructed to wait for contact from their employers, pharmacies, or local health officials. Some other states have more detailed public announcements and data resources instructing eligible groups how to get and seek vaccines. Emulating more of that in Iowa could help allay anxiety about the process. It is wise to prioritize people who are at higher risk of infection or severe symptoms, but we shouldn't get too hung up on who goes first. A contagious respiratory illness is a collective problem, and every vaccine administered benefits the whole community. What's important is that federal and private actors quickly increase supply, and that Iowa has a plan to get all those shots in all those arms. We wish Reynolds had leveraged her close relationship with the former Trump administration to push for a stronger vaccine plan, but that opportunity has passed. Now we hope Reynolds and other government leaders will call on the Biden administration to set higher vaccination goals and hold the new president accountable. And that is today's Cedar Rapids Gazette editorial. Today's At Liberty column from Gazette columnist Adam Sullivan is headlined, Borders Over Businesses at the Capitol. Adam says, which do Republicans love more, unregulated business or borders? Iowa Republicans this legislative session are siding with the imaginary lines we have drawn around countries. An Iowa Senate subcommittee this week gave initial approval to a bill requiring businesses to run new hires through a federal immigration verification database. If passed, Iowa would join a small group of states mandating all or most new workers be checked through E-Verify, intended to keep unauthorized immigrants from working U.S. jobs. However, the federal immigration surveillance system is cumbersome and error-prone. No constituents speaking at this week's subcommittee hearing supported the legislation, the Iowa Torch reported. In effect, it is an unfunded mandate on private companies. An Iowa Association of Business and Industry lobbyists told legislators, per the Iowa Torch, that we don't look at this as an immigration issue. This bill, we really see it, through the lens of business as being a mandate imposed on businesses. Proponents of E-Verify say it is highly accurate and free to us. Neither is true. The system's purported mismatch rate of well under 1% might sound impressive, but on a statewide basis, it's not. If all of Iowa's 1.5 million workers were checked and even 0.1% were erroneous hits, 1,500 Iowans would be falsely flagged. Although the proposed law only affects new hires, that's a snapshot of the possible long-term impact. E-Verify is even worse at flagging actual unauthorized workers. The system catches fewer than 1 in 6 undocumented workers, according to a 2019 report by Cato Institute immigration analyst David Bees, who calls E-Verify, quote, one of the largest government surveillance programs in the United States. So, E-Verify does a bad job, but at what cost? Businesses pay twice. The federal government spends hundreds of millions of dollars to maintain the system paid for by taxes. While it's supposedly free for businesses to use, the setup and compliance expenses are significant. Under a national E-Verify mandate, small businesses would pay $2.6 billion for the free service, according to a decade-old analysis by Bloomberg. That figure could be even higher now. Even if this program were accurate and truly free to use, it would be a disaster for human rights and the economy. Immigrants are vital to the culture and workforce as the workforce is quickly aging and slowing growing states such as Iowa. The U.S. workforce includes $7.6 million unauthorized immigrants. Pew Research Center reported in 2019 that in Iowa, many of them fill essential roles in the agriculture and food processing industries. About 6% of Iowa's population is foreign-born, including both documented and undocumented immigrants. Expanding federal immigration surveillance in Iowa is not only a ploy to crack down on immigrants, it also infringes on entrepreneurs' basic rights to do business with whoever they want, including employees who happen to be born on the wrong side of a river. You can't really be pro-business while you restrict employers' rights to hire. You can't honestly say you're for the free market when you impose burdensome regulations on the labor market. And that's today's At Liberty column from Gazette columnist Adam Sullivan. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, January 29th. We're on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. First of all, the shorter other notices. Deborah J.D., age 67, died Thursday, January 28th. The Poppage Cuba Funeral Service of Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. Also from Cedar Rapids, Donald Duck Fish, age 57, died yesterday. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is in charge of those arrangements. From Iowa City, Brad Kesey, age 75, died Wednesday. The Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City will handle those arrangements. From Marengo, Russell A. Voorhees, age 74, died Wednesday, January 27th. The Kloster Funeral Home in Marengo will assist the family. From Norway, Sandra Marie Schulte, age 76, died Thursday. The Brosch Funeral Service of Norway is in charge of those arrangements. From Wellman, John Butterball, age 72, died Friday, January 15th. The Powell Funeral Home in Wellman will assist the family. And Gail Leroy Yerkes, age 80, of Waterloo, died Wednesday. The Phillips Funeral Home of Vinton is in charge of those arrangements. Now for the longer notices. Dolores D. Heiner McNeil, age 80, died unexpectedly on January 26th. A private funeral service will be held at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home website. A public celebration will be held at a later date. Memorials may be directed to St. James United Methodist Church of Cedar Rapids. Beverly Farrington, age 65, of Anamosa, died on Tuesday, January 26th, following a sudden illness. There is no information given as to services. Bryce Buck E. England, age 81, of Cedar Rapids, died on January 26th at his home. Services will be 11 o'clock Monday morning, February 1st, at Rayback Newhouse Funeral Service in Belle Plaine, with visitation 1 hour prior to the service. The service will be live-streamed through the Rayback Newhouse Funeral Service Facebook page. Burial will take place at Oak Hill Cemetery in Belle Plaine. Buck says, along with your Hawkeyes gear to honor him, please be mindful of everyone's safety and wear a mask. Memorials may be directed to the family. Adam Robert Cookson, age 37, of Grinnell and formerly of Cedar Rapids, died on January 24th at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines of natural causes. Due to COVID-19, a celebration of life service will be held at a later date, yet to be determined. Memorial contributions may be designated to the family and sent to the Smith Funeral Home in Grinnell. Lynn Fear, age 74, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Wednesday at the Hiawatha Care Center. Private services will be held at Cedar Memorial Funeral Home. Visitation will be from 5 to 8 p.m. Friday at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories stateroom. As mandated by proclamation, social distancing must be practiced, which requires a limited number of people to be allowed into the visitation at one time. The use of face masks or shields is required. Burial will be in the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home website. That will be available beginning at 11 o'clock Saturday. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be directed to the Wounded Warrior Foundation. Laquesta H. Doolin, age 85, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Tuesday at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. A Celebration of Life Memorial Service will begin at 1 p.m. tomorrow at the New City Church at 5335 Midway Drive Northwest in Cedar Rapids. Interment will take place at a later date at Linwood Cemetery, a date to be announced. In lieu of flowers, the Cuesta asks that memorials are directed to her New City Church, that they can continue their love and her love for God. Norbert M. Banowitz, age 89, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday. Private services will be held. Burial will be at 1 p.m. Monday in the Sacred Heart Catholic Cemetery in Maquoketa. There will be a visitation on Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. As mandated by proclamation, social distancing must be practiced, which requires a limited number of people to be allowed into the visitation at one time, and the use of face masks or shields are required. In lieu of flowers, please consider a memorial donation directed in Norbert's memory to Keystone Place in Cedar Rapids. The address of Keystone Place is 6126 Rockwell Drive Northeast. Jane A. Sayer, age 69, of Oskaloosa, passed away on December 31st at her home. A celebration of life will take place at a later date. Burial will be at Oak Hill Cemetery in Cherokee, Iowa. The Bates Funeral Chapel is in charge of arrangements. Turning now to sports, is a story about the Gazette itself. The Iowa High School Athletic Directors Association will present its Outstanding Service Award for Sports Media to the Gazette visual staff in a ceremony between games of a girl-boy basketball doubleheader tonight at Cedar Rapids Kennedy. The Iowa High School Athletic Directors Association, which has presented its annual Outstanding Service Award since 1972, recognizes volunteers for their many contributions toward the welfare of students and athletes in the community. In another local event, Cedar Rapids Xavier's Justin Turka took first place with a total score of 486 Tuesday at the Mississippi Valley Conference's Valley Division Bowling Meet at May City Bowl in Cedar Rapids. Kennedy's Dakota Harris at 480 and Luke Dolphin at 478 took second and third, respectively. In a feature sports story written by Jeff Linder of the Gazette, Rivalry Saturday soldiers on. As of this writing, Rivalry Saturday has been whittled to a 3-game schedule. Could be 4. Outside chance of 5. And if the weather lives up or down, depending on the perspective to its forecast, there could be none. Maquoketa Valley girls basketball coach Scott Monk, who doubles as director of Rivalry Saturday, says it's been a big Debbie Downer. The schedule calls for the 17th installment Saturday at Delhi. He says, "We always look forward to having these kids play in a big venue against good competition." The event was originally scheduled as an 8-game collection for November 28th at Coe College, but the pandemic forced a change of date and site. Scheduling complications for participating teams forced the cancellation of 3 games, then a 4th, then a 5th. So the remaining slate has 3 games, starting at 1 p.m. Saturday with defending Class 2A state champion North Lynn, who's now Class 2A number 4, taking on Denver. Monk was efforting Wednesday night and into Thursday in adding a 4th game, which would tip off at 11 o'clock. A 5th matchup, if located, could take place at 7 o'clock tomorrow, but that's a long shot. Snow is forecast to invade eastern Iowa around midday Saturday. Monk has his eye on the weather models and will make a decision on the event's fate sometime today. He said, "We've been really fortunate. We've never had a hiccup because of weather in 16 years. Attendance allowance will consist of household plus 4 others for each participant. Each of the 3 games has promise, but the Cedar Rapids Xavier versus Algona Garrigan encounter at 3 p.m. carries extra intrigue. Xavier is 8-5, Garrigan is 15-0. Last year's 1A runner-up, Garrigan has been a wrecking crew, beating its first 15 foes by an average of almost 47 points per game. The Golden Bears present a matchup problem in sophomore Audie Crooks, a sturdy 6'3 post who has offers from all 4 Division I schools in Iowa, as well as Maryland, Missouri State, and others. Xavier coach Tom Lilly said, "She's certainly a formidable foe. If they get us into a half-court game, it certainly swings in their favor. Our goal is to try to stretch it out and attack." Crooks is averaging 21 points, 10.1 rebounds, and 3.8 blocks per game, and is shooting 72.3% from the floor. Garrigan point guard Molly Joyce, also a sophomore, adds 19.3 points per contest. Lily said, "I don't know them by name. I know them by skill set, and they are very skilled. We'll be playing a very good basketball team." How good? Well, according to the B.C. Moore computer, Garrigan is ranked number 3 in all classes, behind only Johnston and Waukee. North Lynn is the defending 2A state champion. Also in sports, a story written by K.J. Pilcher of the Gazette, a surreal senior night for Hawks Vasky. Dateline Manchester. This was a dream for Tiger Vasky, wrestling under the spotlight on senior night. An electric gym is an intense rivalry. Posting an unexpected fall over a top-ranked opponent, everything seemed surreal last night. Vasky said, "I'm still on cloud nine right now, trying to get back to earth and hoping that it's real. It's all about how it ends. I came out on top. It's an awesome way to end my career at West Delaware." Vasky ignited the West Delaware bench and fans, recording a defensive fall against top-ranked Brandon O'Brien and helping the Class 2A top-ranked Hawks to a 45-21 win over number 5 Independence in a Walmart Conference duel at Seedorf Gymnasium. Hawks coach Jeff Voss said, "You talk about making memories. He'll never forget this Independence duel like the rest of us. What a great memory for him as a senior on senior night, having that happen in front of the crowd. Great job for Ty." O'Brien had his way with Vasky, building a 14-3 lead after the first of the 132-pound bout. He was just 2 points away from a technical foul in the second and held an 18-4 lead with a minute. Vasky kept battling and staying after the state runner-up. As O'Brien was attempting to turn to finish things off when Vasky popped up and caught him on his back for a defensive foul in 5:07. Vasky bounced in the center of the mat as the rest of the West Delaware crowd erupted. He was greeted by frenzied teammates and coaches. Even the youth wrestlers in attendance couldn't contain their excitement as the score was now tied 15-15 near the midway point. The duel was a seesaw affair through the final 8 weights. Independence's Caden Creamer at 106 and 120-pounder Luke Johnson scored pins, and Carter Straw gave the Mustangs a 15-9 edge after 120. Straw scored an escape in the ultimate tiebreaker to top number 8 Blake Engel 4-3. Isaiah Weber's decision at 138 put Independence ahead for the last time. West Delaware won 6 of the last 7 matches. Top-ranked Jared Voss at 170 and Wyatt Volker at 195 scored pins. Jaden Payton at 152 and Kale Meyer at 182 won by technical fall. Logan Payton at 145 and 220-pounder Christian Nunley added major decisions. In other wrestling action around the area, Iowa City City High beat Dubuque Waller 62-16. Marion just got by center point Urbana 39-32. South Tama defeated Marion 65-18. Waterloo West beat Cedar Rapids Jefferson 64-9. Western Dubuque topped Cedar Rapids Washington 48-31. And Cedar Rapids Xavier defeated Waterloo East 48-27. Here's a feature story written by Jeff Johnson of the Gazette. Clear Creek Amana repeating prior success. A lot of folks looked at the personnel losses from last season when perhaps they should have looked at the personnel returning instead. Those latter guys have been the nucleus of what has become another really good boys basketball team at Clear Creek Amana. The Clippers sail into tonight on an 11-game win streak. CCA is 12-2 overall and leads the Wamac Conference's West Division by 4 games. Head coach Brandon Club said, "We did lose some key guys, but we knew we had a pretty good core coming back. I think the seniors, in general, are so close and tight-knit and get along really, really well. We've just really gelled and come together, especially on the offensive end." The coach went on to say, "If you look at our stats, we're built a little bit different position-wise to how we score compared to last year. But they just know each other so well, they don't really care about individual stats or accolades. They just want to score and win games. That's kind of been the difference this year." Clear Creek Amanda put everything together after the holiday break last season, made its way to the state tournament in Class 3A, and finished third. But two of the top three scorers on that team graduated, and starting center T.J. Bowlers didn't go out this season, graduating early and choosing to start his football career early at the University of Wisconsin. Those seemed like really significant departures, yet this team has just kept on going on. Senior forward Christian Withrow said, "Last season, it was a movie. It was just a whole movie. Awesome. Definitely some of the higher points of my basketball career. Winning those big games, how the team came together to win those. Obviously, then going to state. Staying in a hotel with friends was an awesome feeling. Just the whole experience staying in a hotel. Practicing a Drake. Rushing off that court with the stands full. That was amazing. It was one of those things that you'll never forget." Withrow is a returning All-Stater, a 6'2" forward who leads CCA in scoring at 19.4 points per game. Mike Potter, at 10.4 points per game, is the other returning starter for the Clippers. Ryan Navarro, Brock Reed, and Kyle Schleffer were bench guys last season, but have all stepped into starting roles and excelled, averaging right around 10 points each. Navarro is just 6'2", but has evolved into a quite capable replacement inside for Bowlers. Withrow said, "That kid works harder than anyone you'll know." The goal for these Clippers is another trip to state. It's certainly a realistic one. Withrow, whose team's lost two of its first three games, said, "Our season started off a little bit rough, like we did last year, but we still kept our heads up and kept on working. Just the mindset that club and the coaches have brought in is a winning mindset. We're here to change things in how we do things at CCA." In boys basketball last night, it was Dyersville-Beckwin just getting by Albernette 49-48, English Valley's Nip Lone Tree 50-45. It was Iowa Valley over East Marshall 55-45. Monticello took care of Mid Prairie 48-29, and it was West Branch over Tipton 56-37. In girls' games from last night, West Branch whipped Regina 52-36. Albernette sneaked by Beckman 46-41. It was English Valley's over Lone Tree 47-40. Monticello defeated West Liberty 49-46. And it was Vinton Shelsburg all over Olwine 73-18. We have a safety story to report today about shoveling safety. How to prevent injuries when shoveling snow and walking on ice. And we got another dose of winter this week, making it tricky to navigate slick spots on the road and the pavement. Here's a refresher on how to make sure you and your loved ones get through it unscathed by weather-related injuries while shoveling and walking on ice. Dr. Sandra Hunter, a professor of exercise science and director of the Athletic and Human Performance Research Center at Marquette University in Milwaukee, offered tips on how to reduce the possibility of hurting yourself when interacting with Mother Nature. She said, "The more rushed we get, the more we sort of ignore things like a tweaked back when shoveling. And it's just silly. You don't need to do this. You just need to get the car out of the driveway, and that's what I need to do now for shoveling. And then I can do the rest when I get home later. It's just common sense." Hunter offered some tips to stay safe. Prepare. It's no secret that inclement weather is coming, so salt your driveway before the snow arrives so you don't have to shovel as much. Pick the proper clothing. Dress as you would for exercising and for the cold. Think layers. Warm up first. Hunter said shoveling is exercise, and you should warm up for it just as you would before exercising. She said, "It doesn't have to take long. Warming up in some way, shape, or form, even just doing some star jumps like jumping jacks, or even just going up and down some stairs to get warmed up will help. And ergonomic shovels can make a big difference." Hunter said they are much lighter, and they have contoured handles, which reduce the bending that you have to do. Push and don't lift. Once you're shoveling, push the snow rather than trying to lift it. Take breaks and keep hydrated. It's amazing how quickly you overheat and become dehydrated, Hunter added. Some people have had heart attacks while shoveling. It's not uncommon. Pay attention to signs and pains. One just has to listen to their body. If you get shortness of breath, chest discomfort or discomfort down your left arm? Definitely do something about that, she says. When it comes to navigating icy conditions, Hunter said concessions are probably the biggest injury she's seen. She says black ice is especially tricky. To negotiate ice, you've got to keep flat feet, take small steps, and you've got to keep your feet wide apart so you have a big base of support. The bottom line, she says, the right outwear, prep, and shoveling techniques are really important for the winter season. Just do it. Here's another story about some advice that might be helpful to someone. How to take advantage of student loan relief extension. This is by Susan Temper. If you're juggling federal student loan debt along with other bills, you're about to get another pandemic-related break. Those who lost a job during the pandemic and now need to decide whether to pay their student loan debt or buy groceries can hold off making federal student loan payments through September 30th. The temporary pause for federal student loan payments had been set to end January 31st for more than 42 million borrowers. The move means that the interest rate for or interest rate on many federal student loan payments stays set at 0% for another 8 months. Millions of private student loan payments and some federal student loans, however, weren't covered by this deal. Kristen Holt, the CEO of Green Faith Financial Wellness, which is a Michigan-based not-for-profit that offers various services nationwide, including a debt management program and financial counseling on student loans, said that this move means that the interest rate on many federal loan payments stays at zero. It really gives people options to get their financial life in order. Holt said some families may be able to use this time to pay off high-rate credit card debt or other bills. Others, if able, might try to set aside extra cash to create or beef up an emergency fund. Taking care of some other financial headaches, Holt said, will put many families on a better footing once payments on student loan bills must resume later this year. Holt said right now, nothing is forgiven. They still owe that money. The temporary financial break announced in March was extended twice last year and then again, most recently at the request of President Joe Biden, who took executive action on the matter on his first day in office. Holt said many borrowers should consider signing up for income-driven repayment plans even now while the pause is in place. That's because the months when they're not required to make a payment will count in their favor with some income. Income-driven plans that often offer loan forgiveness at the end of a 20-year or 25-year period. Mark Kantrowitz, a student loan expert, noted that the CARES Act specifically counts the payment pause and interest waiver as if the payments were made. Kantrowitz said he generally advises borrowers to consider an income-driven replacement plan if their total student loan debt at graduation exceeds their annual income, especially if they want to pursue public service loan forgiveness. The budget-friendly income-driven plans offered on federal student loans can help you avoid defaulting if your income is low compared with your student debt burden. In general, monthly payments are calculated based on borrowers' incomes and family sizes, and the plans may be more affordable than other options. Borrowers typically should opt for the repayment plan with the highest monthly payment that they can get and that they can afford so that their interest doesn't keep building over the long run. Will there be another pause in payments after September? Well, the Biden administration has left open that possibility, but borrowers would be wise to take advantage of what they know is available right now. Sarah Saddlemeyer, the director of the Pew Charitable Trust Student Borrower Success Project, said financially strapped borrowers need to consider what happens when the payment pause ends. The latest extension, she said, offers essential breathing room for borrowers during a time when many have lost jobs or even their homes during the pandemic. But many borrowers still may face difficulty even if the jobs picture improves, as some experts or some expect once more people receive a coronavirus vaccine. Even before the pandemic, Saddlemeyer said, a lot of families were struggling financially. Family financial security really drives borrowers' repayment behavior. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, January 29th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland, and is used today around the world, and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff, where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap, and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.